welcome to a half hour of Mind Web. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This is Michael Hansen. The Mind Web story tonight is A Saucer of Loneliness by Theodore Sturgeon. Copyright 1953 by Galaxy Publishing Company. If he's dead, I thought, if he's dead, I'll never find her in this white flood of moonlight on the white sea, with the surf seething in and over the pale, pale sand like a great shampoo. Almost always, suicides who stab themselves or shoot themselves in the heart carefully bare their chests. The same strange impulse generally makes the sea suicide go naked. A little earlier, I thought, or later, and there would be shadows for the dunes and the breathing toss of the foam. Now the only real shadow was mine. A tiny thing just under me, but black enough to feed the blackness of the shadow of a blimp. A little earlier, I thought, and I might have seen her plodding up the silver shore, seeking a place lonely enough to die in. A little later, and my legs would rebel against this shuffling trot through sand, the maddening sand that could not hold and would not help a hurrying man. My legs did give way then, and I knelt suddenly, sobbing, not for her, not yet, just for air. There was such a rush about me, wind and tangled spray and colors upon colors and shades of colors that were not colors at all, but shifts of white and silver. If light like that were sound, it would sound like the sea on sand. And if my ears were eyes, they would see such a light. I crouched there, gasping in the swirl of it, and a flood struck me, shallow and swift, turning up and outward like flower petals where it touched my knees, then soaking to the waist in its bubble and crash. I pressed my knuckles to my eyes so they would open again. The sea was on my lips with a taste of tears, and the whole white night shouted and wept aloud. And there she was. Her white shoulders were a taller curve in the soaking foam. She must have sensed me, perhaps I yelled, for she turned and saw me kneeling there. She put her fists to her temples and her face twisted, and she uttered a piercing wail of despair and fury, and then plunged seaward and sank. I kicked off my shoes and ran into the breakers, shouting, hunting, grasping at flashes of white that turned to sea salt and coldness in my fingers. I plunged right past her, and her body struck my side as a wave whipped my face and tumbled both of us. I gasped in solid water, opened my eyes beneath the surface, and saw a greenish-white distorted moon hurtle as I spun. Then there was sucking sand under my feet again, and my left hand was tangled in her hair. She hit my ear, wet, hard, and a huge pointed pain lanced into my head. She pulled, she lunged away from me, and all the while my hand was caught in her hair. I couldn't have freed her if I'd wanted to. She spun to me with the next wave, battered and clawed at me, and we went into deeper water. Don't, I can't swim, I told her, and she clawed me again.
Leave me alone. Oh, dear God, why can't you leave me alone?
So by her hair, I pulled her head down tight to her white shoulder, and with the edge of my free hand, I hit her neck twice. She floated again, and I brought her ashore. I carried her to where a dune was between us and the sea's broad, noisy tongue, and the wind was above us somewhere. But the light was as bright. I rubbed her wrists and stroked her face and said, "It's all right, there," and some names I used to have for a dream I had long, long before I ever heard of her.
Why couldn't you leave me alone?
And she opened her eyes and looked at me at last. She had so much misery, and there was no room for fear. She shut her eyes again and said,
"You know who I am."
"I know," I said, and she began to cry. I waited a long time, and when she stopped crying, there were shadows among the dunes.
"You don't know who I am. Nobody knows who I am."
It was in all the papers.
"That. Nobody knows who I am."
"Well, tell me."
"Who are you?"
"Someone who..."
"Well?"
"Not now. Later, maybe."
"Where are my clothes?"
I didn't see them."
"Oh, I remember. I put them down and kicked sand over them. Just where a dune would come and smooth them over. Hide them as if they never were. I hate sand. I wanted to drown in the sand, but it wouldn't let me. You mustn't look at me. I hate to have you looking at me. I can't stay here like this. What can I do? Where can I go?
Well, here. And she let me help her up and then snatched her hand away, half turned from me.
Don't touch me! Get away from me!
Here, I said again, and walked down the dune where it curved in the moonlight, tipped back into the wind and down and became not dune but beach. Here, and I pointed behind the dune. At last, she followed me. She peered over the dune where it was chest high and again where it was knee high.
Back there? It's so dark.
She stepped over the low dune and into the aching black of those moon shadows. She moved away cautiously, feeling tenderly with her feet back to where the dune was higher. She sank down into the blackness and disappeared there, and I sat on the sand in the light.
Stay away from me.
I rose and stepped back. Invisible in the shadows, she breathed.
Don't go away. There, over there, in the dark. Just be a... Stay away from me now. Be a voice.
I did as she asked, and sat in the shadows perhaps 6 feet from her. She told me about it, not the way it was in the papers. She was perhaps 17 when it happened. She was in Central Park in New York. It was too warm for such an early spring day, and the hammered brown slopes had a dusting of green of precisely the consistency of that morning's hoarfrost on the rocks. But the frost was gone, and the grass was brave and tempted some hundreds of pairs of feet from the asphalt and concrete to tread on it. Hers were among them. The sprouting soil was a surprise to her feet, as the air was to her lungs. Her feet ceased to be shoes as she walked. Her body was consciously more than clothes. It was the only kind of day which in itself can make a city-bred person raise his eyes. She did. For a moment she felt separated from the life she lived, in which there was no fragrance, no silence, in which nothing ever quite fit, nor was quite filled. In that moment, the ordered disapproval of the buildings around the Pallid Park could not reach her. For 2-3 clean breaths, it no longer mattered that the whole wide world really belonged to images projected on a screen, to gently groomed goddesses in these steel and glass towers, that it belonged, in short, always, always, to someone else. So she raised her eyes, and there, above her, was the saucer. It was beautiful. It was golden, with a dusty finish like that of an unripe Concord grape. It made a faint sound, a chord composed of two tones and a blunted hiss, like the wind in tall wheat. It was darting about like a swallow, soaring and dropping. It circled and dropped and hovered like a fish, shimmering. It was like all these living things. But with all that beauty, it had all the loveliness of things turned and burnished, measured, machined, and metrical. At first, she felt no astonishment, for this was so different from anything she had ever seen before that it had to be a trick of the eye, a false evaluation of size and speed and distance that in a moment would resolve itself into a sun flash on an airplane or the lingering glare of a welding arc. She looked away from it, and abruptly realized that many other people saw it, saw something, too. She looked up again, and at last began to realize how large and how far away the saucer was. No, rather, how small and how very near it was. It was just the size of the largest circle she might make with her two hands, and it floated not quite 18 inches over her head. Fear came then. She drew back and raised a forearm, but the saucer simply hung there. She bent far sideways, twisted away, leaped forward, looked back and upward to see if she had escaped it. At first, she couldn't see it. Then as she looked up and up, there it was, close and gleaming, quivering and crooning right over her head. She bit her tongue. From the corner of her eye, she saw a man cross himself. And she thought, he did that because he saw me standing here with a halo over my head. And that was the greatest single thing that had ever happened to her. No one had ever looked at her and made a respectful gesture before. Not once, not ever. Through terror, through panic and wonderment, the comfort of that thought nestled into her to wait to be taken out and looked at again in lonely times. The terror was uppermost now, however. She backed away, staring upward, stepping on a ludicrous cakewalk. She should have collided with people. There were plenty of people there, gasping and craning, but she reached none. She spun around and discovered, to her horror, that she was the center of a pointing, pressing crowd. Its mosaic of eyes all bulged, and its inner circle braced its many legs to press back and away from her. The saucer's gentle note deepened. It tilted, dropped an inch or so. Someone screamed, and the crowd broke away from her in all directions, milled about and settled again in a new dynamic balance, a much larger ring as more and more people raced to thicken it against the efforts of the inner circle to escape. The saucer hummed and tilted, tilted. She opened her mouth to scream, fell to her knees, and the saucer struck. It dropped against her forehead and clung there. It seemed almost to lift her. She came erect on her knees, made one effort to raise her hands against it, and then her arm stiffened down and back, her hands not reaching the ground. For perhaps a second and a half, the saucer held her rigid. And then it passed a single ecstatic quiver to her body and dropped it. She plumped to the ground, the backs of her thighs heavy and painful on her heels and ankles. The saucer dropped beside her, rolled once in a small circle, once just around its edge, and lay still. It lay still and dull and metallic, different and dead. Hazily, she lay and gazed at the gray, shrouded blue of the good spring sky, and hazily, she heard whistles and some tardy screams, and a great, stupid voice that bellowed, "Give her air!" which made everyone press closer. Then there wasn't so much sky because of the blue-clad bulk with its metal buttons and its leatherette notebook.
Okay, what's happened here? Stand back, for God's sake.
And the widening ripples of observation, interpretation, and comment.
It knocked her down. Some guy knocked her down. You knocked her down. Some guy knocked her down and... Right in broad daylight, this guy. The park's getting to be...
Onward and outward. The adulteration of fact until it was lost altogether because excitement is so much more important. The glittering shield in the florid face, bending close. Are you hurt bad? And the echoes back and back through the crowd. Hurt bad. Badly injured. He beat the hell out of her in broad daylight. And then another man, slim and purposeful in tan gabardine, cleft chin and beard shadow.
Fine saucer, Okay, officer, I'll take over here. FBI.
And that rippled outward, too. The policeman nodded. The entire policeman nodded in one single bobbing genuflection. FBI. FBI. The crowd murmured. There was more sky to look at above her. She sat up, and there was glory in her face. And she sang, "The saucer talked to me."
"He'll be quiet," said the gabardine. "He'll be quiet now. He'll have lots of chance to talk later."
"Yeah, sister,"
said the policeman.
"Oh, my God, this mob could be full of communists, you know."
"You be quiet, too," said the gabardine. Someone in the crowd told someone else a communist beat up this woman, while someone else was saying she got beat up because she was a communist. She started to rise, but solicitous hands forced her down again. There were 30 police there by that time, and she told them that she could walk, and they told her to take it easy. At the hospital, she had a bedroom to herself then for the first time in her life. Whenever the door opened, she could see a policeman outside. It opened very often to admit the kind of civilians who were very polite to military people and the kind of military people who were even more polite to certain civilians. She did not know what they all did, nor what they wanted. Every single day, they asked her 4,500,000 questions. Apparently, they never talked to each other because each of them asked her the same questions over and over. There would be a lot of shouting ones and then a lot of kind ones. No one had ever been so kind to her before. But she soon learned that no one was being kind to her. They were just getting her to relax, to think of other things, so they could suddenly shoot that question at her. "Oh, what do you mean, it talked to you?" Pretty soon, it was just like Mom's, or school, or any place. And she used to sit with her mouth closed and let them yell. They took her out of the hospital and put her in jail. Some ways it was good. The food, the bed was all right, too. Through the window, she could see lots of women exercising in the yard. It was explained to her that they all had much harder beds. "You are a very important young lady, you know," they told her, and that was nice at first. But as usual, it turned out they didn't mean her at all. They kept working on her. Once they brought the saucer into her, it was inside a big wooden crate with a padlock and a steel box inside that with a Yale lock. It only weighed a couple of pounds, the saucer, but by the time they got it packed, it took two men to carry it and four men with guns to watch them. They made her act out the whole thing just the way it happened, with some soldiers holding the saucer over her head. It wasn't the same. They'd cut a lot of chips and pieces out of the saucer, and besides, it was that dead gray color. They asked her if she knew anything about that, and for once, she told them. It's empty now. The only one she would ever talk to was a little man with a fat belly who said to her the first time he was alone with her, Listen, I think the way they've been treating you stinks. Now get this. I got a job to do, and my job is to find out why you won't tell what the saucer said. I don't want to know what it said. I'll never ask you. I don't even want you to tell me. Let's just find out why you are keeping it a secret. Finding out why turned out to be hours of just talking about having pneumonia and the flower pot she made in second grade that Mom threw down the fire escape and getting left back in school and the dream about holding a wine glass in both hands and peeping over it at some man. And one day she told him why she wouldn't say about the saucer just the way it came to her. Because it was talking to me. And it's just nobody else's business. She even told him about the man crossing himself that day. It was the only other thing she had of her own. He was nice. He was the one who warned her about the trial. I have no business saying this, but they're going to give you the full dress treatment, judge and jury and all. Now, you just say what you want to say. No less, no more, you hear? And don't let him get your goat. You have a right to own something. He got up and swore and left. First, a man came and talked to her for a long time about how maybe this Earth would be attacked from outer space by beings much stronger and cleverer than we are. And maybe she had the key to a defense, so she owed it to the whole world. And then even if the Earth wasn't attacked, just think of what an advantage she might give this country over its enemies. Then he shook his finger in her face and said that what she was doing amounted to working for the enemies of her country. And he turned out to be the man that was defending her at the trial. The jury found her guilty of contempt of court, and the judge recited a long list of penalties he could give her. He gave her one of them and suspended it. They put her back in jail for a few more days, and then one fine day they turned her loose. That was wonderful at first. She got a job in a restaurant in a furnished room. She had been in the paper so much that her mother didn't want her back home. Mom was drunk most of the time. And sometimes used to tap the whole neighborhood, but all the same, she had very special ideas about being respectable, and being in the papers all the time for spying was not her idea of being decent. So she put her maiden name on the mailbox downstairs and told her daughter not to live there anymore. At the restaurant, she met a man who asked her for a date. The first time, she spent every cent she had on a red handbag to go with her red shoes. They weren't the same shade, but anyway, they were both red, and they went to the movies, and afterward, he didn't try to kiss her or anything. He just tried to find out what the flying saucer told her. She didn't say anything. She went home and cried all night. Then some men sat in the booth talking, and they shut up and glared at her every time she came past. They spoke to the boss, and he came and told her that they were electronics engineers working for the government. They were afraid to talk shop while she was around. Wasn't she some sort of spy or something? So she got fired. Sometimes she would be all right for months on end, and then someone would ask for a date. Three times out of five, she and the date were followed. Once, the man she was with arrested the man who was tailing them. Twice, the man who was tailing them arrested the man she was with. Five times out of five, the date would try to find out about the saucer. Sometimes she would go out with someone and pretend that it was a real date, but she wasn't very good at it. So she moved to the shore and got a job cleaning at night in offices and stores. There weren't many to clean, but that just meant there weren't many people to remember her face from the papers. Like clockwork, every 18 months, some feature writer would drag it all out again in a magazine or a Sunday supplement. And every time anyone saw a headlight on a mountain or a light on a weather balloon, it had to be a flying saucer. And there had to be some tired quip about the saucer wanting to tell secrets. And then for 2 or 3 weeks, she would stay off the streets in the daytime.
Then she hit on the idea of the bottles. She got all the bottles she could and wrote on papers, which she corked into the bottles. She would tramp miles and miles up and down the beaches and throw the bottles out as far as she could. She knew that if the right person found one, it would give that person the only thing in the world that would help. Those bottles kept her going for 3 solid years. Everyone's got to have a secret little something to do. And at last the time came when it was no use anymore. You can go on trying to help someone who maybe exists, but soon you can't pretend there is such a person anymore. And that's it. The end. Are you cold? I asked when she was through telling me. The surf was quieter, the shadows longer.
No. Did you think I was mad at you because you saw me without my clothes?
Well, why shouldn't you be?
You know, I don't care. I wouldn't have wanted you to see me even in a ball gown or overalls. You can't cover up my carcass. It shows. It's there, whatever. I just didn't want you to see me at all.
Me or anyone?
You.
Didn't the FBI try to stop you throwing those bottles?
Oh, sure. They spend I don't know how much taxpayers' money gathering them up. They still make a spot check every once in a while. They're getting tired of it, though. All the writing in the bottles is the same.
Well, so what?
All of them. Judges, jailers, jukeboxes, people. Do you know, it wouldn't have saved me a minute's trouble if I'd have told them the whole thing at the very beginning.
Really?
No, they wouldn't have believed me. What they wanted was a new weapon. Super science from a super race. To slap hell out of the super race if ever they got a chance. Or out of our own if they don't. All those brains. All that brass. They think super race, and it comes out super science. Don't they ever imagine a super race has super feelings, too? Super laughter, maybe, or super hunger? Isn't it time you asked me what the saucer said?
I'll tell you. It said, there is in certain living souls a quality of loneliness, unspeakable. So great, it must be shared, as company is shared by lesser beings. Such a loneliness is mine. So know by this that in immensity, there is one lonelier than you.
Dear Jesus. How is it addressed?
It's addressed to the loneliest one.
How did you know?
It's what you put in the bottles, isn't it?
Yes. Whenever it gets to be too much, that no one cares, that no one ever did, you throw a bottle into the sea, and out goes a part of your own loneliness. You sit and think of someone somewhere finding it, learning for the first time that the worst there is can be understood.
The moon was setting and the surf was hushed. We looked up and out to the stars.
We don't know what loneliness is like. People thought the saucer was a saucer, but it wasn't. It was a bottle with a message inside. It had a bigger ocean to cross, all of space, and not much chance of finding anybody. Loneliness? We don't know loneliness.
When I could, I asked her why she had tried to kill herself.
I've had it good with what the saucer told me. I wanted to pay back. I was bad enough to be helped. I had to know I was good enough to help. No one wants me. Fine. But don't tell me no one anywhere wants my help. I can't stand that.
I found one of your bottles 2 years ago. I've been looking for you ever since. Tide charts, current tables, maps, and just wandering. I heard some talk about you and the bottles hereabouts, and someone told me you'd quit doing it, that you'd taken to wandering the dunes at night. I knew why. I ran all the way. I got a bad foot. I think right, but the words don't come out of my mouth the way they are inside my head. I have this nose. I've never had a woman. Nobody ever wanted to hire me to work where they'd have to look at me. You're beautiful. You're beautiful. She said nothing. But it was as if a light came from her.
more light and far less shadow than ever the practiced moon could cast. Among the many things it meant was that even to loneliness, there is an end for those who are lonely enough, long enough. Saucer of Loneliness, a story by Theodore Sturgeon, copyright by Galaxy Publishing Company, 1953. I'm Michael Hansen. Reading with me was Tricia Day. Technical production for this broadcast by Rich Grody.